Coming up on this week's show, a mysterious Nintendo prototype is uncovered.
Play a sensible sucker clone on your Spectrum.
We celebrate Sega's legendary console with the Dreamcast Junkyard.
And the Retro Hour podcast is brought to you each and every Friday with our amazing friends at Bitmap Books. Now, if you want a good read for the summer, Sinclair ZX Spectrum, a visual compendium. Relive the glory days of the Spectrum with this award-winning collection covering over 100 classic games, including legendary titles like Hungry Horace and The Hobbit, and spanning 304 pages. Make sure you check this out if you're a Spectrum fan, and the rest of their retro gaming collection at bitmapbooks.com. And with our mates at PCBWay, who offer a fully featured custom PCB prototype service with low-cost, fast turnaround quality boards, and they do services like 3D printing and injection molding. And you know they're big supporters of the retro community. So get an instant quote for your retro project right now at PCBWay.com. Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 377, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news with me, Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And great to have you joining us for another packed episode of the podcast that every single Friday takes you on a nostalgic trip back to the classic age of video games. And of course, brings you up to speed on all the big happenings in the world of retro. You don't have to look around at all the blogs and the websites and the social media accounts and Google around. That takes a lot of time. Let us do it for you. Every week we bring you up to speed on what's been happening. And of course, we bring you a very special guest in the second half of the show. Now, I'm hoping that Joe Fox is going to sound nice and relaxed, almost vertical on this week's podcast, having come back from a week in the sunshine in Tenerife.
Yeah, you know, feeling relaxed, feeling chill, putting the stress on Dan because we're recording this literally like a day before the episode comes out because I decided to jet off. So thank you very much, guys.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, you've been away on holiday, and I know obviously when us geeks go away, I remember, you know, when I went away to Rome with my missus a couple of years ago, we're going to take a day trip to the Vatican, but on the way there, stumbled across a really cool retro gaming museum, ended up spending all afternoon in there instead. So generally, we do get a bit distracted. And I did see on your social media accounts that you might have been doing a bit of retro gaming when you're on holiday in Tenerife.
I did actually. They had an arcade in the hotel, and they had like a really, really pristine copy of, arcade machine of Gunblade New York, which was just like crazy. I think that came out in like 1994.
I've never heard of that one. Gunblade New York. Sounds
yeah,
fun.
It's a first-person shooter with like big vibrating machine guns by Sega. And
basically, right up your street pretty much.
Yeah, and you fly around in a helicopter blasting people in New York, you know, terrorists kind of thing. So definitely put a few euros into that. I got about halfway through it. And then revisited it on like the last day of the holiday because, you know, you have to pay, spend your last few coins that you can't get exchanged. But that was really it. There was on, because we stayed in an all-inclusive for my daughter. And those who know a classic British holiday, you know, the all-inclusive, they have like the mini disco and the games nights and stuff. And they did a retro games night on one of the nights. And my daughter fell asleep in the restaurant. So we had to take her back to the hotel room, and I missed it. I missed the whole thing. Oh,
that was your time to shine, Joe.
That was my time to shine. I said to my missus, and I said this to Ravi as well on text, I said, the warrior would have been there. You know, you don't mess with the warrior.
Like, the warrior. I bet the word got around, you know, Joe from the Retro Hours here. We need to, you know, make him feel at home. Let's get the Mega Drive set up. And then he didn't show up and broke the little heart.
I don't know what it was. I've got a feeling, because it said retro video games, I've got a feeling it was probably going to be a Wii. I said to my missus, it's probably a Wii. Let's be honest, with Wii bowling and stuff like that. But even then, I would have been quite excited. And I did do a little Google to see if they had any retro game shops in Tenerife on the little island. And they do. But unfortunately, I was like 2 hours away from them.
Interestingly, so, they had, you know, those virtuality machines, the Amiga virtual reality ones. I know that quite a few of them made it over to Tenerife. And
Really?
There's a guy, Simon Marsden. He works at the Retro Computer Museum in Leicester. He actually bought some from Tenerife and bought them back. So I think a lot of the kind of old arcades like made it over there as well.
I said to my missus, I said, you know what? The chances of there like being dusty House of the Dead arcade machines like knocking about on, you know, in Tenerife or Spain or whatever is much more likely than them knocking around in the UK these days, I imagine, you know, because of this probably still in like hotel lobbies and stuff like that, you know.
I've got these visions of your missus being around the pool and kind of looking through the glass, and there's you with your virtuality headset on playing Dactyl's Nightmare and ignoring all the sunshine and everything.
100%. 100,000,000% that would have been me getting into trouble for not spending time with my daughter.
Well, glad you had a nice holiday, Joe. Nice to have you back. And I know things are kind of ramping up now as the summer months are here. Not long until Ravi's massive Amiga event. Just a quick reminder, of course, there are still some tickets left. We keep getting people saying, you know, is it a sellout yet? It's not far away now, is it? We've only got a couple of months until Kickstarter 01, the massive UK Amiga Expo that's going to be happening on the 1st and 2nd of July at Meadow Lane Football Ground in Nottingham. So at the time of recording this, we've got about 50 days to go. There are still some tickets available if people are quick, is that right?
Yeah. We've got about 50 tickets left for the Saturday and more for the Sunday because, you know, the Sunday always requires a bit of like extra focus as well, and you know, there'll be a lot of people nursing hangovers and stuff. It's going to be awesome. I've announced a lot of the speakers at the moment. I've just put up the Traders Hall, so this is going to be a proper big expo, and in Amiga Addict magazine, the next issue, we're going to be like covering the event and talking about like how it came together and stuff. So it's really exciting, and I can't wait personally. I've just got to stop adding things to it, because if I do too much, then, you know, there won't be much time. So I'm doing a few things, but making sure they're really good, you know.
It's a weekend event, not a week long.
Yeah. You know me, I love Amiga. I could go on forever. I have a month-long festival.
Well, that's the thing. Hopefully, it's a bit of a tester, really, isn't it? So, you know, we want everyone there, and hopefully you're going to do another one next year and keep it going regularly if it's a success.
Yeah, because I've kind of, like, set this up myself, you know, getting the numbers and capacity. It's always hard to work out these things, you know. You never know if you haven't got that, like, guaranteed audience. So this year, we're kind of working out what the audience is going to be like, and then hopefully we can expand it and grow it. But, you know, it seems to be selling well, which is fantastic. And, I just can't wait.
Loving your guest list as well. Mike Daly from DMA Design is going to be there, talking about Lemmings and those classic games. Mev Dink as well from Vivid Image. Of course, we've had him on the podcast before. Simon Fripps from Core Design. John Hare, Sensible Software. I imagine there's going to be a Sensi soccer tournament there. There's got to be.
It's at a football stadium, so, you know, there's got to be a Sensi soccer game.
So tickets are available for that now. Like we said, you know, use them or lose them if you want to see this event regularly. You know, we want to see as many people there as possible. So the website is amigashow.com, and hopefully we'll see you there. All those guys are going to be there for the UK Amiga Expo Kickstarter 01 coming on the 1st and 2nd of July in Nottingham. This week, though, on the podcast, it is all about a different machine, because we're going to be covering the legend that is the Sega Dreamcast.
Yes, absolutely legendary console, and amazingly one that's still like got such love and development. And part of that is, you know, the Dreamcast Junkyard. They've been a community that have been going for years, and they've been supporting the Dreamcast. And they've also got like the Dream Pod as well, which is a fantastic podcast. And you think, like, you know, the Dreamcast, it was a good console. It had a bit of a short kind of life as a console, but there's still so much going on. It's absolutely amazing. So we've got Mike and Lewis from the show there, and we're talking about stuff like modern games being created on the Dreamcast and ported. And I don't know about you, Joe, but I've seen like some really high-end ports done. I don't think I've seen on any other console this kind of attention to detail, but also the idea that they go out and actually get these games licensed and say, we're going to release this on the Dreamcast. It comes out with official packaging and, you know, a manual. It's pretty amazing to see.
Yeah, the Dreamcast, like the community behind it is like, it never stopped, it feels, and it was just, it's amazing to see, like, there's more games released of the Dreamcast every year than there was in the final actual kind of, like, year or two of the Dreamcast's actual commercial, like, lifespan. And yeah, just talking to Mike and Lewis about that and how they got into the Dreamcast and how they got into the community, and then actually finding out that Dreamcast Junkyard actually started as a blog pretty much at the end of the Dreamcast's life. Like, they've been doing it for, like, something like 18 years, I think they said, the Dreamcast Junkyard has been going, which is just absolutely crazy. And then, you know, I didn't realize, I've been listening to their podcast, they've got over 100 episodes now as well of Dream Pod, which is really cool.
And it's mad because, like, not only games are coming out, we're also getting hardware. So there's stuff like the updated VMUs that have come out. Mm. There's new controllers and stuff. And it's pretty amazing. Also, we do talk a bit about if a Dreamcast Mini is going to come, which is one thing that we constantly talk about on this podcast.
I like their opinion on that as well, because they've got a pretty firm opinion on whether or not that's going to happen.
Yeah.
So it's interesting. And actually, Dreamcast, I was in Leeds over the weekend, and I went into CEX, and I bought myself a Dreamcast light gun for 15 quid in there.
Oh, nice. Wow. Have you got a good CRT to run it on?
Oh, of course. You know I do.
Several CRTs to run 20.
Yeah. It's Dan. He's got a wall of them.
It's how I heat my house. The Dreamcast is obviously a console that I think... We've talked about it before, the fact that obviously it had that period when it didn't do very well when the PlayStation 2 came along. But really, it feels like since then, it really is the console that the retro gaming community have really taken to heart. You know, everyone loves a Dreamcast. So it's going to be a really interesting chat with Mike and Lewis from Dreamcast Junkyard, our special guests. They'll be on the show in around half an hour from now. Now, of course, before that, we're going to bring you up to speed on what's been happening. Another busy week in retro. And something else has been very topical recently, and thank you to Jania, who posted this on our Discord channel, because we do have a little channel in our Discord that you can join via our website, theretrohour.com. Go in there. There's actually a little section where you can submit news stories as well. So if you spot anything, you think that'd be a good story for the show, pop it in there, and hopefully we'll cover it in a future episode. But he posted this seemingly unreleased prototype for Tetris. Now, of course, Tetris has been all over recently because of that Apple documentary that was on Apple TV recently that we all loved, or that docudrama more, wasn't it, really? But this apparently shows what could have been a version of Tetris for the Nintendo Game & Watch.
Yeah, it's a strange one, this, isn't it? Because of it's not been confirmed whether it's actually, like, real or not, but it looks legitimate, and it kind of tracks out. So it's in the shell of another Game & Watch game. It's using the shell of Safe Buster, which is one of the other Game & Watch games, but then the actual game itself is Tetris, and it's... In terms of the Game & Watch, it's running quite well, but there isn't any more kind of like information about it. But I tried to do some digging and stuff like that, and pretty much when the Game Boy came out in 1989, that's when Nintendo, obviously, all their focus just went from the Game & Watches onto the Game Boy, because Game & Watch started in 1980. And I think there was only a couple more released after that. The last one was released in 1991, so it would make sense with Tetris being such a huge seller for the Game Boy as well. You know, it kind of made the Game Boy, didn't it? You know, it makes sense that they were probably thinking of putting it on the Game & Watch and then decided not to because of it was selling so well on the Game Boy. So I can see the legitimacy of it, like, you know, from the speculation of like the whole story. But it'd be great to find out if it is actual proper prototype. It says it is, but you know, there's no confirmation of that.
You never know with these things, and it's weird as well, because you know, the Game & Watch, you've got two screens on there, obviously.
Yeah.
And on the top one, you've got these two characters as well. I'm not sure if I can identify them. You might know them, Joe, but it works differently. It doesn't work in the way that a traditional Tetris game works, where you have the kind of main area with your blocks where they land, that's usually stationary. In this one, you actually move that area left and right.
Yeah, I found that really strange.
Which is really odd. Like, yeah, I've not seen that before. So you're actually moving the area left and right, and then the blocks are landing into the kind of spot that you've picked, rather than just manipulating the block and then moving that and dropping that in.
It's as if the board, like the game board on the bottom screen, doesn't fit on the Game & Watch screen, but that feels like that would be an oversight. That, you know, I don't feel like Nintendo would like, oh, they would like miss that. Does that make sense? So it kind of looks purposeful. And like you say, you move the bottom screen, and it took me a minute. Like, the video is like 4 minutes long, and it kind of took me like a minute and a half to kind of figure out what was going on, because I was like, wait, he just placed that box and now it's moved? Like, can he move them after he's placed
them? And the weird
them?
Thing is as well, you can have lots of patterns on the bottom as well, because it seems like as you move it, you've obviously got a wider space. Mm. So more options. So it kind of changes the gameplay completely to compared to, you know, Tetris, where it's on one screen or something like that. And maybe it's the format of the screen as well, the fact that it's, you know, it's horizontal. And
Yeah, maybe. Maybe.
Yeah, 4x3 kind of.
Maybe. You could be right there. Maybe they've done it. They did it on purpose and they made it kind of like, you know, they wanted to make it different to traditional Tetris, or because of the screen aspect ratio, like you say, they had to do it like that. But it definitely puts an interesting spin on it. It just took, you know, because of like Tetris is in like your muscle memory. It's like everybody knows how to play Tetris. And then all of a sudden, you're moving the bottom screen like that. It just really threw me off. But as for the characters at the top, I thought it was Dr. Mario at first, which would kind of make sense because of he there was like the Dr. Mario and Tetris game pack for the SNES. I'm not sure if it came out on Nintendo as well, but
yeah, that was around 1990 that game came out, didn't it? So I guess if they were, you know, if they were making the version for the Game & Watch before it got discontinued in 91, that would kind of work out time-wise that it would be him. But yeah, it is strange because they kind of throw the Tetramones down a little like neck, don't they? And then it gets wider at the bottom on the second screen. And then you've got to kind of wrap the play field around the block. And it's a very weird way of playing it. I mean, you know, you may be looking at it thinking, obviously Tetris wasn't as well known then, obviously, as it is today.
Yeah.
So maybe they were still kind of figuring out, you know, what was the best way to play it.
Maybe.
Or maybe it was just because of the power of the Game & Watch as well. You know, it's quite a low-powered device compared to the Game Boy.
And a very low screen resolution as well. I mean, this is a... It is a Japanese Twitter user called Vectrex0904 who's posted a few pictures of it as well, and there's a little video that you can watch too. But again, I mean, it's all in Japanese. There's no kind of information on where they've got this from or, you know, whether it is completely legit. So I'm hoping more details about this are going to come out, because if that is a legitimate kind of alternate reality version of game of Tetris that would have come out on the Game & Watch, maybe instead of the Game Boy, that would have changed a hell of a lot in video game history, wouldn't it? So it'll be interesting to find out a bit more about that story. So if you want to check out those tweets, there's a great article on there, Time Extension, that I'll link up in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, if we're talking about, you know, games that are definitely up Joe Street, you know, you love your light gun games and your first-person shooters, and Castlevania, obviously one of your favourite franchises. And this is something I must admit I'd really heard about before, but this is Castlevania the Arcade. There's apparently a bit of a lost game in the Castlevania franchise that now looks like it could be available to more people and playable at home on your PC.
Yeah, this I found this really interesting. So I saw this originally on a group on Facebook and kind of dismissed it as like, because of it's Castlevania the Arcade playable on PC, and as you say, it's claiming it's a bit of a lost game. And I was
Even though you can't use the controllers, it's
playable
on the PC.
We'll get that. We'll get to that. We'll get
on the PC.
We'll get to that. But yeah, I was like, oh, okay, is this the weird haunted house Castlevania game from the 80s, which played like a really janky version of Castlevania, but with really big sprites? I dismissed it and didn't read it at first. And then it came up again. And I was like, oh, I'll have a look at it. And it's a video. And I was like, oh, it's an actual... like arcade game that came out in 2009 in Japan only, and it's based on that kind of like PS2 era Castlevania kind of graphical style, obviously released by Konami because they own Castlevania. But it was a massive flop. Like, it didn't sell well, it didn't do very well at all, and it's become a really, really rare cabinet. And it was a really big cabinet. So the premise of the game is it is essentially a first person shooter, but you use Wii remotes which resemble whips, but they've just got like a flashing light on the end, and you hold it like out in front of yourself, like a whip, but like a Wii remote. And that's how you know, fight the enemies, because you whip enemies in Castlevania. And it's two player, but it's a really, really wide cabinet, and it's like a stand up cabinet, but it's got like a back piece to it, which has got like a big Castlevania like artwork on it and stuff. So it's a really, really big arcade machine. And I can imagine, you know, 2009 arcades are dying, you know, I know Japan's very, very different, but, you know, for whatever reason, it just flopped. Never came out of Japan. You know, maybe there's some cabinets knocking about in private collections and stuff like that.
I did read that apparently there was a couple that were kind of dropped into test markets in Europe, maybe only two cabinets, but the whereabouts of those is not really known now.
Oh, wow.
So it looked like there was like, an English language version in the works. At
least. Oh, wow. Okay, that's super rare then, two of them. But it was recently, or it's coming up to the 35-year anniversary of Castlevania. And to kind of like celebrate this, somebody has dumped the ROM online for everybody to go and have a look at and download and try and get it working and play. And they've dumped it directly from the arcade board.
Well, actually, looking at this, it's not an actual arcade board. So I've looked into this more, and it's a thing called the Konomi PC.
Oh, in the video,
inside
the
units. Okay. Yeah. So what it is it's actually, it's a bit lazy, but it's a Windows XP machine.
Oh wow!
That they had in there, but it had like a protection dongle in there. So that was the Konomi PC arcade hardware. So actually, this is native. This is running in Windows XP. So what they've managed to do is they've managed to go into the code of the executable file that's running on Windows, so it's not emulated, and they've changed some of the configuration settings in there so that it does fit on the screen and it works with Windows 10, but they haven't managed to get the controls working with it at the moment. So it's kind of like they've taken this weird Windows XP kind of version that was built for arcade and managed to shove it into the modern PC. But the fact that it's PC based and it's, you know, based on the same processors and stuff, it's going to be really easy to fix this up, I can imagine, and just put some new drivers in there for controllers and stuff and get it going. And I was amazed when I looked at this Konomi PC that it was just this embedded Windows XP machine.
Well, it makes sense because, I mean, you know, doing custom hardware is very expensive, and PCs by that stage, you kind of got to the point where they could easily run games like this.
Yeah.
You know, 2009 era PC could run like, you know, PS2 style graphics without, you know, breaking much of a sweat. So it does make sense that it do that. And I mean, you know, there is a great video if you want to kind of check out where it is right now. It's about 9 minutes long on a YouTube channel called Video Game Esoterica, and he uploaded this about 4 days ago at the time of recording this episode. And basically they're saying they want some help with this, aren't they? So they've got it to a stage now where they've got it running on Windows 10 with a couple of tricks, but like you said, they need some help with from the community to basically get the controls working as well. But if that arcade was pretty much just Wiimotes, then I can't imagine, you know, because you can interface Wiimotes with
I guess there's going to be some like hacked drivers, or there'll be some kind of way of doing it. But also looking at this, if they can get this sorted, then there's other titles on there like Metal Gear Solid Arcade 3D and about a million Pro Evo titles as well and stuff that you could probably have running in the same way.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you want to join in this this effort to kind of get it up and running, they have got a Discord server. They're a little bit vague about where to actually get the ROM from. All they say is, search for Castlevania the Arcade on that archive site. So I imagine that means the usual one that we go to, archive.org. So I haven't checked to see if it's there, but, you know, obviously they might not want to draw too much attention from Konami just in case. But they have got a Discord server that you can hop on, I'm sure, you know, some will provide you with a link on there if you want to get that up and running. But I do think it is very cool because, I mean, it's weird though, because 2009, when I read that, I was like, oh, that's a recent game. Yeah, it's nearly 15 years ago. I was like 2-year-old. But I think, you know, in terms of the fact that computer hardware hasn't changed all that much in a decade, so the fact that they can actually just do a few patches and get it running on a modern Windows 10 machine, hopefully just getting the controls sorted, and this will be a game that everyone can play really easily with kind of commodity hardware. So very cool to see that preservation effort. And if you want to check out more about that, I'll of course put that in our show notes at theretrohour.com. Now, one thing that isn't going anywhere anytime soon is AI. Anyone sick of hearing about artificial intelligence yet?
Well, yesterday you were sent over an AI clip of the Retro Hour, which I thought was absolutely hilarious because it made me American and made Ravi really.
Do you want to hear this again then, Joe? So I've got the audio.
Have you got the audio? Have you? Brilliant.
I have. Because, I decided, because I mean, I keep reading all these stories, what, you know, AI is going to take our jobs, it's going to be the future. I even heard that, you know, it's going to start hosting podcasts and everything as well. And there's a service called 11 Labs. Well, basically you upload a little sample of your voice and it claims to clone your voice and be able to basically deliver a perfect copy of it. I've got a feeling it doesn't work all that well on our accents though. So if you want to hear what the Retro Hour would sound like, maybe in the future, you know, if one of us gives up the show or...
One of us dies, you just replace us with AI.
Just replace us.
I've got a feeling the technology might need to come on a little bit further. So this is what the Retro Hour would sound like, hosted by AI.
Hello and welcome to the Retro Hour podcast, episode number 400, your weekly dose of retro gaming and technology news. With me, Robot Dan Wood.
Me, Ravi Abbott.
And me, Joe Fox.
And a very warm welcome to the podcast that every week from now on is run by robots. We're sitting at home playing games while artificial intelligence takes our jobs.
Yeah, sometimes I don't get enough time to play Resident Evil, so I thought if a robot does the podcast instead of me, I can play it more. Great idea this, Robot Dan.
Yeah, and it will give me more time to tend to my garden. Right now I'm growing massive juicy plums. Oh, and some spuds.
I don't know what to say.
It's weird though, because there is, Joe said this to me, there is a little twang of all of us in there, isn't there?
There's a little bit of a twang. There's a little bit of a twang. I think, you know, the intro where it says, "I'm me, Joe Fox," like, it sounds sort of like me, but then it goes American for me.
It can never do regional accents. Like, yeah, Siri had a problem for a long time.
It seems to lose it after the intro a little bit, but yeah, man, it is crazy.
Yeah, Ravi's tending to his garden.
Always.
Well, Ravi's a king gardener. But yeah, I mean, it's at the stage where hopefully it can't replace our jobs yet, but it looks like, you know, it could be coming for level designer roles, because this is quite interesting. This was shared in our Discord as well by Hop. Thank you for submitting this story. This is a service called Mario GPT. Now, this is an open-ended text-to-level generator for Super Mario Brothers maps. Now, this is a bit like basically an AI version of Mario Maker, but instead of having to manually place things on the screen, you just give it some really simple prompts and it will then design you a playable Mario map.
Yeah, it's also got a lot more intelligence in it as well than something like just ChatGPT, which is just kind of a response program. This also has, it's called the Video Game Level Corpus, which is a AI learning model, which has come from Cornell University. They've uploaded it and they've used machine learning. So we've talked about this on the show before. You've had these like DeepMind and projects learning retro games and learning how the levels work. So it's got a basis of machine learning and like human computer interaction AI research that it's using as its kind of data set. And then it's creating these like procedural generated ones, which is interesting because it's got that history and idea of how a level works, which, you know, I can imagine if ChatGPT just did one on its own, it would be a bit more mental than this. You know, these levels look a bit consistent and they've kind of got, you know, big jumps in them, small jumps, and it does seem like it's a lot more intelligent. But they've also got it running in Python as well, so you can actually run this script. It takes it out of this, you know, deep learning subset that it's got, builds this environment, and it looks really interesting, because I was just looking at what they have on this video game level corpus, and it's not just Mario. They've trained it on a Mega Man, Rainbow Island, Super Mario Kart, Legend of Zelda as well. There's Doom as well. So, you know,
obviously,
they could use these kind of deep learning sets and then use them to help design levels or design it quicker or come up with procedural generation and add it into a game that didn't have that previously.
Because I know when I've made Mario Maker levels, I mean, it's quite a time-intensive process, you know, to get a good playable level. But here, I mean, it actually shows you a few examples of, you know, prompts that you can type in. For example, if you want to make a basic level on Mario, I mean, it's all based on pretty much Mario 1, isn't it, here?
Yeah.
So you write in, you know, many pipes, many enemies, little blocks, low elevation, and it will generate the map then. Or you can do no pipes, some enemies, many blocks, high elevation, and then the platforms will be higher up. So you can basically just describe to it. You know, it can be as simple as many pipes, many enemies.
Yeah, that's really cool. It's like a kind of searchable way of doing it. And yeah, I think you're right. Like Mario Maker, it's really hard because am I going to make that jump? Am I going to do that? You know, every single time, where this deep learning already knows, oh, that jump's tough, this one's easy. So it kind of
takes the fun out of it, if I'm honest, you know, just typing in, make me a level. But it is impressive to see, though, and I think it does kind of, I mean, there's two things here, isn't there? There's whether it's going to, you know, I imagine AI is probably going to help in terms of level design in video games, you know, to kind of make things a bit quicker. But also, it also, you know, for retro games like this, it kind of gives you infinite possibilities to kind of, you know, if you're bored of a game and you know the layout inside out, to kind of give it a variation and kind of have new spins on classic games.
Do you think
as well,
Nintendo's going to sue it every time it creates a new one?
Take the AI to court.
Has AI that generates takedown notices that then goes against that.
That's how Terminator starts, more of the AI. But yeah, it does look very interesting though. So if you want to have a look at this right now, in his early days at the moment, but it does look very impressive and actually very easy to use
this
as well.
This is where I think AI is going to excel, where it's a combination of things, you know, and you're not fully reliant on the AI, but you're using it to do something. You've got human input there as well, but you're also using like data sets and stuff. It's really interesting.
Yeah, so that's called Mario GPT, and like Ravi mentioned, it's written in Python, so you can get that now off GitHub for free. So I'll link that up in our show notes if you want to check it out. Now, obviously, we're getting into the time of year when you might want to go outside, enjoy a bit of fresh air, and obviously football as well. That's quite a big part
Dan
of summer.
Dan says that with such enthusiasm.
is football season coming up soon? I have no idea. But yeah, obviously, I mean, you know, for us nerds, sitting indoors playing video games in the summer holidays, that's what it was all about. But this looks very cool now. There have obviously been, you know, football games for the Spectrum in the past. I mean, you know, Kevin Toms, who had him on the podcast, legendary Spectrum football game back in the day. But this one, submitted by Retrohamer, by Gareth, in our Discord channel, basically looks like a kind of clone of something like Sensible Soccer, or maybe Kickoff, for the ZX Spectrum.
Yeah, you're completely wrong. Football season's just about to end.
It's always, proves how much I know.
Yeah, it's always cricket in the summer. But
why don't they play football in the summer? Surely it'd be nicer outside then.
Oh, no, it's all about the winter and pies and being cold on the terraces. World Cup and all of that stuff in the summer. But this looks really like Sensible Soccer. Like, even to the menu, they've got like Specky written at the top, and it's done in the kind of Sensible Soccer fonts. I'm really impressed with this, the way that it scrolls up and down on the screen. And it's kind of got that like seamless scrolling, you know, there's not any juddering or anything. The characters look amazingly close to Sensible Soccer, the layout of it, the way that it flows as well. This is interesting. I'm not that knowledgeable on the Spectrum and the kind of requirements that it needs, and also like the speed. Is this for a more powerful Spectrum then?
Yeah, this runs on the, it's all 128K Spectrum models, okay, which, you know, were available back in the day. You know, they were the later models. But also it works on stuff like, you know, the Spectrum Next, obviously. But I think in terms of what they've packed in here, so this is a game, I mean, it's called a Specky Soccer Community Edition 2023. It's by a Voxel Tower, and it's one of these name your own price games.
That's really so you can nice. Go on there. I like that idea, name your own price, yeah.
Whatever you want to pay for it, I mean, it's entirely up to you. But it looks like definitely, I mean, you know, I'm not a football fan at all. But in terms of a Spectrum football game, I can't imagine that you could pack any more details and any more features into a game on the humble ZX Specky than this.
It's got every team's badge in it as well. It's 120 teams that they fit into there. What I really like is that you can play four players at the same time. As well, four simultaneous players, which is pretty amazing. It's got the kind of management options in there as well. It's got a CPU player as well. So, you know, you don't have to have a friend there. You can just play. And that has three different levels as well of skill on there. The music's all right as well. It's, you know, got music.
It is a Spectrum.
Music and sound effects at the same time. And all importantly, it has that one button that does everything. So as Amiga users, we know about that. And, you know, a lot of these games relied on like one button. So you kick it and then kind of curve the ball afterwards and stuff like that, and do your slide tackles with it and stuff. It looks really fun. It is pretty much a Sensi clone. I'd like to see a bit more kind of speckiness in there, you know, maybe a bit color clash, get Dizzy on the sidelines, you know, something like that.
Manet walking past the top of the screen or something. I mean, it does look great though. I think in terms of all the stuff they've got in here, I mean, you've got tackles in here, you've got passes, you've got fouls in here, yellow and red cards as well, you know, injuries are in here, penalties as a referee, substitutions, there's, you know, realistic ball physics
They've got, you know, AI in there as well, you know, to do the computer, the CPU players. And the amount of characters and sprites they fit on the screen as well is something you don't normally see.
Yeah, that's the impressive thing to me. You know, they've got that many people going around, that many people controlling it, and it's smoothly going up and down, you know.
Yeah, so if you're a football fan and you want what pretty much looks like the ultimate football game for your ZX Spectrum, it is available now, and I'll link that up. Obviously, like I mentioned, it's a pay what you want, name your own price game, but definitely worth supporting. Support that, and all the rest of the stories we talk about, you don't have to Google around. You find them all in your show notes on the podcast app or at theretrohour.com. Now we are well into May now. That means only a couple of weeks until the next Patrons Hangout coming up at the end of this month. And that also means, you know, another episode of our bonus podcast, The Retro Hour After Hours. Now, for people that haven't joined us on Patreon, we do give you a lot of perks, don't we, Ravi?
Oh, yes. We absolutely shower you with perks at Patreon, you know. Yeah, we've got some awesome stuff like the After Hours podcast. I don't know how many of them we're on now, but it's
35.
35, yeah. So if you join up, you get a RSS feed, and within that feed, you get an ad-free episode, might get it early as well, but also you get that whole back catalogue, so you can put it into your, you know, app. I use Apple Podcasts, and I put the feed into there, and then you have the VIP feed, and it's really awesome. We discover so much stuff on the After Hours podcast as well. We're talking about, you know, games we've never played before, talking about obscurities, different systems, and I like it because it's really kind of casual. We've been experimenting a bit with video on that one as well. Ooh. Yeah, which is interesting. And we also do the hangouts, which are really good fun as well, where we get everybody on camera. And it was really interesting. We did one last time, which was on a Friday, and usually we do them on the Sundays, but it's quite nice doing it on a Friday because we got a lot of people from the States that usually wouldn't be able to make it on the Sunday and stuff. So, you know, that's something we might consider kind of alternating the times as well. But yeah, it's really good fun. It's a really great community. And, you know, I'm looking forward to meeting a lot of patrons at the Kickstart event as well, because there's quite a few people coming over.
Yeah, we've got a great community. We're chatting, you know, all week in Discord too. You know, it's just, if you want to join the Retro Hour community, there's a wonderful bunch of people, you know, like we say, you know, with Jen, we've become mates, haven't we? You know, a lot of us now. So it's we'd love to see you there for the next Patrons Hangout. Also going to be doing a few more news stories just for our patrons. We do that every week. You get a longer episode if you sign up to Patreon. But of course, the main reason that you're doing it is just to ensure that we can keep bringing this podcast out to you every single Friday. And we hugely appreciate your support. And let's induct our latest members into the Retro Hour Hall of Fame.
Hall of Fame!
A massive thank you to our latest sign-ups, including Jeunesse Kladnik,
Steve Dickinson,
Simon DM,
and James Stewart, who all joined us on Patreon over the last couple of weeks. We massively appreciate your support, and if you'd like to do the same, all the details to sign up right now are at theretrohour.com. Now, just a little timely reminder, my every couple of months nag that, you know, if you do enjoy this podcast and you'd like to help us out, Apple Podcast reviews, we love those, don't we? We haven't had any for a couple of months now. But of course, if we get, you know, some nice reviews on Apple Podcasts, helps us get up the podcast chart in front of new people. You know, if you want a really simple way of helping the show out, a little 5-star review on there, a couple of nice words, we'd really appreciate that. And, you know, get us in front of more people, that's always appreciated. And next, we're going to be going deep inside the world of Sega's legendary console with the guys from Dreamcast Junkyard.
You're listening to The Retro Hour with our very, very special guests from Dreamcast Junkyard, Lewis Cox and Mike Phelan. How are we doing, guys?
Yeah, I'm good. It's a nice day outside, and we're about to talk about the Dreamcast, so can't be better, really.
Good stuff. And you all good, Mike?
Yeah, I'm doing good, doing good. Pleasure to be here and looking forward to talking about Dreamcast.
Fantastic, great stuff. So then, our first question we ask all our guests is going to be for you, Lewis, is what was your first video game memory and your first home system?
Yeah, I wasn't really allowed home consoles as a kid, and I think my parents thought that I wouldn't focus on my schoolwork, which in retrospect is pretty much correct, really, so they kind of did a good thing there. But I was allowed handhelds, so my first system, which was I got, was on a Christmas day, and it was a lime green Game Boy Color with Pokemon Red, which I play to death and loved very much. But even earlier than that, my memories of gaming were watching my granddad, of all people, play games. So he'd play games like Alundra and Tomb Raider, and I remember watching him, and he'd patiently work through all these different puzzles. He really liked puzzles in games. Like he loved games like Ico and Project Eden. Those are some that I remember he really liked. And then he'd also taught me my kind of first lessons about gaming. So, you know, I learned to make sure you run before you jump, because that means you get further, and also thoroughly search around an area, and you know, you might have missed a hidden item or something like that. So that's a habit I still have today. And when I play online with my friends, it annoys the hell out of them. So yeah, that's all thanks to him. But yeah.
Was he quite a young granddad, or like a hip granddad? Because of, I can't say my granddad was playing Alundra, which I think is really cool, by the way.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, I'm still gobsmacked that he finished the game, because that game is hard as nails. And I've still never managed to get that far in it. But yeah, he was just a normal age granddad, but he was kind of cool in the sense that he was always like, you know, he'd listen to contemporary music and, you know, just watch new films. You know, he was cool like that. And yeah, his favorite game was Elder Scrolls Oblivion. That was his favorite game ever, and he once asked me if they'd ever make a game better than it, and I don't think they have, so there you go.
Oh, there we go. He's certainly cooler than me, because I'm stuck in my old ways and sat here talking about Dreamcast. He was more hip than me. So the same question for you, Mike. What was your earliest video game memory and your first home system?
So I'm somewhat older than Lewis. I'm reminded by every day. But it's so my history goes back to the 80s, and my first system at home was a Spectrum 128K. And I think before that, I probably played a couple of other machines. I had a Pong machine at home. I had a couple of other sort of TV built in devices, as it were, from what I remember. But yeah, Spectrum was the first one. So Spectrum, I absolutely loved Spectrum. It was just a whole new world opening up. Spent many, many years playing Dizzy games or Chaos, 3D Death Chase, all the classics. So yeah, Spectrum was my first one. My first console was actually the Master System, so it was straight after Spectrum. So my first console experience was a Sega machine, something I'd continue for some years afterwards.
And what's both your personal history with the Sega Dreamcast? You know, what makes it a special console to you both?
So I was around the age of 7 when the Dreamcast came out, and I had a friend who had one, and I have a lot of amazing memories of going to visit him, you know, during summer holidays, and we'd just play Power Stone 2, Quake 3 Arena, those kind of games, and it was like some of the best memories like during that time. And you know, the fact that you could play with 4 people was mind-blowing to me. Obviously, I knew that the Nintendo 64 obviously could do that prior, but you know, my cousin had a Nintendo 64, but like they didn't really play it like 4-player game. So yeah, I was playing the Dreamcast, and I was just like blown away by like how good all the games looked. And you know, a game like Power Stone 2, like it looked like the anime I was watching on TV at the time, like Pokemon, Dragon Ball, Tenchi Muyo, stuff like that. And it was like, you know, anime characters in a 3D environment. It looks amazing to me. And I'm thinking like, how can games look this good and I can play them together with my friends? You know, because I've always loved playing, you know, games multiplayer, you know, couch co-op especially. And so, you know, I'm thinking that this new console is like the coolest thing ever. I was a little bit confused by the fact that the you had to load the memory cards from the controllers. I don't think I'd quite figured out that was cool just then, but I didn't realize until recently that the Dreamcast had actually been discontinued, because I was playing this console with him, like, you know, when it was out to like all the way up to like 2002, but I just thought it was the coolest thing ever. And until I moved house and I was denied Dreamcast for many years, and all the new friends I'd made were like, oh, that don't have a Dreamcast. They all had PS2s. You know, no one I knew except that guy had one. But my proper Dreamcast story comes later, which is around like 2011 when I was in college. Had my first job and I was buying Dreamcast stuff and rediscovering it. You know, I'm buying Power Stone and all those games I played as a kid. But I'm also like actually discovering for the first time games like Jet Set Radio and Shenmue. And at the time it was the seventh generation, and it was that kind of quick transition and hype over, you know, first person shooters, very gray games, you know, not bad by any means, but like, you know, I'm playing Jet Set Radio, which is like an absolute mind-blowing, colorful experience, you know.
Yeah.
And then obviously in contrast was what was going on at the time. And so, yeah, it was like pretty amazing just playing all these Dreamcast games and discovering ones, you know, I'd never had the chance to play at the back when it was out and contemporary. So, yeah.
So it's funny as well, because like you say, you mentioned, you know, the gray era, you know, the gray era of like 2007 to like probably like 2013, 2014, where like every game was Killzone and every game was, you know, Modern Warfare, and there's definitely like that kind of like gray or desert look to them. So, you know, it must have been funny being the guy playing a Dreamcast, you know, he's got his like Technicolor kind of like, you know, TV kind of things. So that's really cool. So Mike, what about you? What's your history with the Dreamcast?
I had a Dreamcast when it was contemporary. I was a PC gamer mainly at the time. So sort of 96, 97 time, I sort of stopped playing consoles, really.
Yeah.
I went to PC gaming. And the Dreamcast had a pretty big reputation amongst PC gamers at the time. I think a lot of the games were different and so graphically impressive. I think a lot of PC gamers started realizing that maybe the experiences were now coming to consoles as well. So I worked in a large shop which sells Dreamcast games, sold Dreamcast games. I'm not going to mention the company because I still work for them. But I was basically, the console was there, and I decided, I think on my third or fourth pay packet, to buy a console. So I had a Dreamcast at the time. I did love the Dreamcast. It was a great console, but I didn't really love it as much as maybe, well, as I do now. It was always my second platform. PC was almost my first platform. It was sort of, it was never really the primary thing. So I sold it. I say sold it, I think I left it at an old girlfriend's house.
Gutted.
And a few years later, I walked past a game station in Bristol, and there was a Dreamcast and Shenmue 2 in the window for, I believe, about £20. At that point, I was just getting into retro gaming, but buying lots of old consoles. So I bought a Dreamcast. It was amongst my, I think, 90 consoles I had at one point.
Ow.
And then sort of maybe 10 years ago, 11 years ago, I started aiming towards something rather than just buying random stuff. Also, this is a time when you could go to, I used to go to Gloucester quite a lot. I went to Gloucester and I would literally pick up 3-4 carrier bags full of games for £100 or something like that. And that would be, you know, 150, 200 games in there. It was ridiculous. So I tried to get a little bit more centered on what I wanted to do. And the first thing I wanted to do was collect Dreamcast. I had good memories about what I did play, and it was quite cheap. So I then really focused on Dreamcast. And then again, like 5 years after that, I wanted to downsize what I had in my games room. And I decided basically to go full in for Dreamcast, which is when I started my main part of my journey, when I started collecting all different versions of Dreamcast games, consoles, accessories, merchandise, and ridiculous amount of Dreamcast stuff I'd now have.
Well, you said, Mike, that, you know, you walked past and you saw a Dreamcast. Like, the actual console stood out quite a bit. It was notably different from the previous kind of Sega machines. And also just being white, it was like, wow, that's pretty stunning. And the form factor, how much of like the controller and the design of the console really appealed to you?
Well, I think, again, because I played it at the time, discovering it years later was obviously a different sort of experience for me. It was more nostalgia. But at the time, I think it was just very revolutionary. I think the console design was very un-Sega-like. It wasn't really what the other Sega consoles had been like. And the controller, yeah, I mean, I'm not the biggest fan of Dreamcast controller, even now. You know, I've probably put in several tens of thousands of hours on Dreamcast. I'm still the biggest fan. But everything looked quite space age, which is it's quite appropriate. If you look at some of the original concept art for Dreamcast, it was very much sort of built to be this sort of spaceship design. And I think that's appealed to me at the time. I was the right age, I think, for it to appeal to. It was that late 90s chic. And it was, yeah. But I think the years later, when I discovered Dreamcast again, even then, it did, as you said, it did stand out. It wasn't this sort of plain-looking console. Although the actual console itself is relatively simple in its look and design, it's very sleek and very, yes, that's very appealing, I think.
So you mentioned that, obviously, the Master System was your first home console. And then, you know, you said you were kind of a Sega boy through and through. What are your thoughts on the Sega Saturn? Because I find personally, I don't know about you guys, but the Dreamcast certainly gets a lot more love than the Saturn.
Yeah, I think the Saturn just didn't hit off in the UK. I think the Saturn was up against a marketing behemoth in the PlayStation. I think Sony threw so much money at that, I think it was obviously going to win. And I think Saturn just couldn't quite compete with it. I don't think the fact that the Saturn had the greatest 3D output helped. I'll get hate mail from the Saturn fans for that. But it's a fact. I think we all know it's a fact that especially the early 3D stuff wasn't as good as the PlayStation, the 3D effort. So that was a problem. And I think also that it appealed more to the arcade gamers. It had some great arcade games. But I think that wasn't what gaming wanted to be at that time. I think the mid-90s, I think it started getting into that sort of more long-form experience. It's a bit odd because the Dreamcast went back to the arcade roots, and that was an appeal then. I think for the time when the Saturn came out, it just didn't quite hit what the public wanted. I love the Saturn, by the way, but I never owned one at the time. It just didn't appeal to me at the time.
I think that was a very political answer. I like that.
if it helps, my granddad did have a Saturn but didn't have a Dreamcast, so I don't know what that says.
Yeah. Interesting.
He's a pioneer there with the Saturn.
He was pretty rad, yeah.
Yeah, all I ever got was one of those Tiger Electronic ones from my grandma's. I was thinking, Lewis, you know, like, the Saturn didn't have that Sonic game that everyone wanted, and Sonic Adventure coming out on the Dreamcast, how much do you think that helped it and, you know, really made people think this is the system for the new Sonic?
I mean, I think Sonic Adventure kind of gets a bit of flack in the community. There's people who love it, there's people who hate it. I think it's almost as much of a Marmite-y game as Shenmue, which I'm sure I'll mention later, but I don't think any person who even dislikes Sonic Adventure as a game can't deny the absolute awe that of that opening level of the Emerald Coast, the music, the beautiful, like, you know, blues of the ocean, and of course that incredible sort of action sequence of the whale chasing you is just like, wow. You know, obviously they skipped over Sonic, you know, a mainline Sonic game at least, you know, for the Saturn, but I feel like that opening is just like coming back into the fold of flying colors, you know, and you know, that was a pretty incredible sort of showcase of Sonic on this you know brand new Sega system.
The first time I saw it was actually in Beatty's in Nottingham. Really? And I went in there and they had a train collecting section. They had a console section, and then in the corner they had a CRT and they were playing Sonic Adventure. And it was kind of, you got a bit put off foot. You were like, what, there's a new Sonic and it's 3D and it looks amazing? What is this? You know? Yeah, it was a real, real kind of impressive move to see that.
Definitely.
So then, let's talk about the Dreamcast Junkyard. So, what inspired the team to start Dreamcast Junkyard website, and how did it come about? What's the story there?
Yeah, so the origin story started with one Mr. Tom Charnock nearly 18 years ago.
Wow.
He had a similar story to what Mike was just talking about. He went past a branch of Game Station, rest in peace, and Game Station, not Tom.
Good clarification there.
Yeah, and he saw a Dreamcast for sale in the window. You know, obviously the prices then were ridiculously low for the Dreamcast because no one wanted it, unfortunately. Story is he actually sold his Dreamcast for a PS2. Boo. But yeah. Anyway, so he buys this Dreamcast and he's reliving his you know, the games and re-experiencing the games he loved previously. And I think he just kind of went in, you know, dived in deep with it. And he, you know, he starts to quickly amass a collection, and he's, you know, parcels are showing up, you know, every other day, maybe even every day. And he has all of these games and peripherals piling up in his room, and his housemate at the time remarked that his room was becoming a Dreamcast junkyard. So that's where the name comes from. And yeah, so he started a blog, the Dreamcast Junkyard, and it was originally a personal blog for him to document this collecting he was doing, and, you know, playing a game and talking about it, that kind of thing. But over the years, he like brought in more people, and you know, it kind of the Dreamcast Junkyard blossomed into what you see today, which is kind of a jack of all trades Dreamcast publication. So, you know, we do reviews, we do video content, we've got our podcast, the Dream Pod, which I'm sure we'll talk about soon. You know, and there's a team of passionate fans who do it, you know, and just to shout them out, you know, other than me and Mike, you've got people like Andrew, Brian, Kev, James and Lawrence. And yeah, we just kind of, that's where we are today. Just, you know, just keeping the Dreamcast love alive.
Fantastic. I was literally about to say keeping the Dreamcast alive.
Yeah, keeping the dream alive, I guess.
Keeping the dream alive. Yeah. Brilliant stuff. So how did you both get involved with the Dreamcast Junkyard? What's your story, Mike? And then we'll find out your story, Lewis.
So I talked about my sort of collecting journey for a Dreamcast, and one of my main sources at the time was the Junkyard. So I found it on a Google search, I think, one day, and I just really got really interested in what Tom was talking about and some of the other early guys as well. And so I sort of followed that, and then I started collecting, and I got quite big into collecting and wanted to collect a lot of the variants and import games. So I was making a list, as I tend to do, I'm that kind of boring person. And I made a list, and I decided I was going to send it to Tom randomly. And sort of saying, look, you know, this is the list I've made. I think it's quite detailed. What do you think? And then within a few weeks of that email, Tom had proposed to actually publish the list as a guidebook. And so I sort of had that. And then I wasn't part of the team. And then I sort of ended up being part of the team a little bit because of that. And then joined properly with a couple of random articles and reviews. And then the rest is history.
And what about you, Lewis?
Yeah, so I came a little bit later than Mike. I used to run a website called AltMag for about 10 years, and it was basically just games, anime, that kind of stuff. I was writing about all the good stuff, and I knew Tom because he was kind of an inspiration to my writing. I remember reading the Dreamcast Junkyard when I was first setting up AltMag, and just I really loved Tom's writing style. It's very dry and very indicative of like 90s, maybe early 2000s gaming magazines. And I was, that kind of influenced my own writing. And I think quite a few other people, you know, that were inspired by Tom's writing as well. But I guess he took note of my writing, you know, and eventually he asked me to actually write for the Junkyard. So, I did, and I was like, of course, like, absolutely I will. You know, I got involved with like the other things, like the Dream Pod and stuff as well. But yeah, and then fast forward to 2023 in February of this year, Tom actually decided to step down running the day-to-day of the website. So I was like, could I take it over from you and, you know, sort of do all of that stuff? And so that's what I did, and now I'm kind of, I guess, just editing articles and whatnot on the site, and just, yeah, all the boring parts, I guess.
But, the general manager.
Yeah, but it's still great. It's still like, you know, I was saying this as a fan, you know, now is, you know, this, the Dreamcast Junkyard's like always been like the definitive source for Dreamcast stuff on the online, and you know, to think that, like, you know, I'm able to be part of it is pretty amazing, really. So yeah,
awesome.
Well, Lewis, I was interested in the kind of spread of the Dreamcast, like, around the world. You know, how kind of long did it stay popular for, and were people still developing whilst you were working for the junkyard, and which countries was it also really popular in?
Well, there were actually a few games that were coming out while the junkyard was still around, like, sorry, while the junkyard was, you know, after the junkyard had been established. So you had games mainly in Japan, like, I think only in Japan after 2005. Obviously, like, is it, how do you pronounce, is it Karas or Crow? Karu, that's the one. Yeah, so games like that were coming out for the Dreamcast still. So it's like kind of almost a bit mad to think that the Dreamcast Junkyard was kind of covering a contemporary system in a way. So
but was it really popular in America as well then?
Mike, would you say it was popular in America? Probably more so than Europe, possibly.
I think there were certain games that are popular. I think, you know, the sports games are really popular in America, but as a console, I think it's very quickly, obviously they got the PS2 early in us as well, so as soon as the PS2 came out, I think the console lost its popularity. I think it probably was more popular in Europe, possibly, than America.
Yeah, you know what? I always noticed Sega Saturn was more popular in Japan, you know, than it was in Europe and in America, but I always kind of saw the Dreamcast as being, I don't know why, I could be wrong, but I always saw it as being more popular in Europe than it was in America. You know, maybe I'm making that up in my head, but, you know, it's interesting that, you know, Dreamcast Junkyard kind of started and it was still, you know, I guess on life support, you know, kind of like in terms of a mainstream console in Japan, which is really interesting. So tell us about the DreamPod podcast. What can listeners and fans expect to hear on that?
Yeah, so the DreamPod came out in 2015, and the name comes from the fact that Dreamcast and podcast both end the same, so they just took the first half of both of those and stuck them together. You get DreamPod. And I suppose if people check it out, they're gonna kind of get what you do here at the Retro Hour. So it's just a chill chat of a group of passionate fans, except we specialize in exclusively in Dreamcast. And we have, like, different styles of episodes. So we have news roundups, themed episodes. So, like, for example, we did an episode where we talked about every Capcom game released for the Dreamcast. We had a funny episode. There's a lot. we did an episode themed on Room 101. That was episode 101. We did one about Room 101, the TV show, and kind of a, we have a few opportunities where we poke fun at the Dreamcast. And that episode, we were throwing our least favorite thing about the Dreamcast into Room 101 for it to be banished for eternity. And then we also do quite a few interviews. One of the most notable ones we had in the last year or so was episode 100, which was an interview with Peter Moore, who was the president of Sega America during the Dreamcast. That was a great interview. We're currently up to 115 episodes. So other than maybe like some extra special episodes or episode zero that are like unnumbered, but yeah, 115 at the moment, and yeah, still continuing to this day.
I was wondering, like, is it still a big console in 2023? We're seeing like a lot of games coming out for it, and why do you think this is?
Yeah, I think the console is hitting its golden age in terms of its retro charm. I think, you know, every console sort of 20 years after its demise tends to be the sweet spot. The Dreamcast has had a really good history with indie releases anyway for the last 20 years, but I think the ease of making games for the Dreamcast comparatively to other consoles of that sort of generation, the amount of different, you know, bits of technology which are now being released to allow you to play off the games from SD card or things like that. And also, I think it's a little bit, it goes back a little bit to what Lewis said earlier on, but I think Sega's, the aesthetics of the Dreamcast are just very bright and cheerful and happy. And I think that something which a lot of people are yearning for possibly at the current time. But yes, it's a big console. I mean, it's not, you know, it's not up to the level of contemporary consoles, obviously, but We have a pretty packed schedule of indie releases. I think we're up to nearly 70 retail indie releases now in total, which is pretty impressive, really. I mean, you know, it's bigger than some games libraries.
Also, hardware releases as well. So we're seeing stuff like the VM2, you know, the next generation VMU. That's also like, you know, controllers and devices still coming out, which is really interesting to see.
Yeah, I think, and there's been a few others. You know, we've had, you know, wireless light guns, obviously you can't play light guns on flat screen TVs. We've seen the light gun adapter. We've seen, the controllers, Retro Fighters, I think, wasn't it? Retro Fighters, Retro Brawlers. Wow, quite a controller a couple of years ago. Yeah, it's just, I think it's just a console which is still relatively cheap to buy. It's not, until quite recently at least, didn't have that really high level value associated with it. So I think it was a really good console without a massive amount of gatekeepers involved. So that was, I think that's the reason why the console's so popular still now.
Yeah, I think that you've also got a very passionate community surrounding it, of like developers and, you know, fans alike. And so you've got, you know, other than just indie games, you've got stuff like DreamPy, which is bringing the console back online, and, you know, they're reverse engineering, you know, the way the games play to get them back online. It's like, you know, it's like witchcraft. I have no idea how they managed to do it, but it's pretty incredible. And then also you've got, you know, people porting stuff like the Atomos Wave, which was an arcade board that had similar architecture to the Dreamcast. And so, you know, those games are being made playable on the Dreamcast, which is like, here's new games you can play that are, you know, a lot of them are very great looking 3D games. And it sort of almost feels like you're kind of getting a new Dreamcast game, so to speak, in that sense, like from back in the day. But then also there's like translators, and they're translating Japanese games into English, and so there's games that maybe we looked at back in the day and thought, oh, I wonder what that is, but you know, we never got the chance to play them due to the huge language barriers, and they're bringing games like that into to us now. And so it's like, just so much, there's just more than ever, there's just so much to play on the Dreamcast, and yeah, it's amazing.
It really is a fantastic community. And have you seen that like kind of evolve over the years? Has it been a steady kind of increase because of, like, you know, the Dreamcast community at the moment? And as you say, Mike, the amount of games that come out for it in homebrew is just unreal. Like, has it always been like that? Has it been kind of like steady through the gate? Or is it more of like a recent thing, like after COVID, where a lot of people just started translating these games? What have you kind of seen over the years?
I think it's always had a really good indie scene. I mean, the first indie games came out in, I think, 2003, 2004. I might be able to slightly wrong year there, but Goat Store in America released some indie games. So we've had a steady trickle of indie games coming out. I think COVID and the lockdowns, I think, just centered people a little bit more. So we saw, as with other consoles, we saw a massive price rise. But with Dreamcast, it was really quite extreme. I mean, you know, the prices, especially in America, doubled pretty much within a couple of weeks. It was a ridiculously quick increase in pricing, which is always a bit weird, because the console, which is probably the least protection for games of any sort of generation of consoles, so, you know, you can literally download games. But yeah, the scene is getting bigger, I think, year on year. I think there's more and more people getting involved with it. I think you've got more people discovering the Dreamcast as well, which is always brilliant. And I think also you've got a lot of people talking about Dreamcast. Obviously, we're on a podcast here talking about Dreamcast, but when the DreamPod first came out, I mean, it was the first Dreamcast podcast.
Yeah.
As far as we know, it was the first Dreamcast podcast. And I'd say I published the list, the glorified list. It was pretty much the first Dreamcast book. It's become a much bigger thing now. So that's a benefit to all of us, especially us, me and Lewis, because it means we can talk about the console even more than we already do.
Yeah. I will add, you have stuff as well like GDMU, and that allows people to just swap out that dying GD-ROM drive from their Dreamcast for something that just plays games off an SD card. So it's like easier than ever to just dive in and find some new games or play the ones you played back in the day.
That's brilliant. It's good to see like nobody kind of like gatekeeping it either or anything like that, and you know, like such a welcoming community with, you know, with things like that, what allow people to just to kind of get stuck in with it and stuff. So that's fantastic. So how do you guys kind of stay up to date with news and developments related to the Dreamcast and its games? Like, you know, so many years after it's been discontinued.
I will say that, like, over the years, we've kind of got the privilege, like, we're in kind of a privileged position in the sense that, like, people, you know, contact the junkyard and say, hey guys, like, you know, I've got this, you know, new indie release, or I've got this new thing I'm working on, like a homebrew thing. And so we kind of get, like, contacted that way. So that's, like, really cool. But I think if you want to like get to the beating heart of the Dreamcast community, even before it goes up on the junkyard, I'd say go on the Dreamcast Talk forums or any of those kind of similar discords where you see like developers posting stuff. And like people, like there's a guy called Ian Michael who just does homebrew stuff just because he wants to, you know. He made like a Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles collection for the Dreamcast where you can play all the old games. It's just because he wants to, and that's like the beauty of it. So like we find out a lot of that from forums, and obviously, like, yeah, I say, people contact us. So yeah, like if you want to know exactly what's going on, like, in real time, just get on one of those forums and find out. Yeah,
Mike, do you think like a lot of the Dreamcast technology has kind of enabled it to be used in the future, and, you know, stuff like the VGA output that you could get on there, and the online capabilities, and the I remember, was it the Rumble Pack, or it was a Punch Pack or something, wasn't
it's not
it?
Like not like the Jump Pack, is it?
Jump Pack,
yes. That was one of them that I remember, yeah.
Yeah, I think it's a really forward-looking console. It was, weirdly enough, because I think a lot of the games on the console were actually harking back to Sega's past, and it's, you know, it's brilliant arcade roots. But the console itself, yeah, had loads of really, you know, interesting technology, and some of it was skipped from that generation. I mean, the Xbox and PS2 didn't necessarily bring into it quite as much as Dreamcast did. So, you know, the VGA output, which meant that when I got back into Dreamcast, and sort of around the sort of 2010 sort of time, the Dreamcast was one of the best looking consoles. And I didn't just mean from the graphics that the console produced, but I mean in terms of the actual output on flat screen TVs. It looked superb. But also, yeah, the VMU, I mean, the VMU was a pretty amazing, I'd say amazing addition. It's a very innovative, a very of its time innovation, which hasn't sort of lasted many years afterwards. I think the original Xbox did have capabilities of things like that as well, didn't it? It was going to at some point. Her screen and the controller was pretty innovative. The VGA output, the online, you know, it's many, many people's first online experiences.
Yeah.
Were the Dreamcast. I mean, you know, in 1999, not everyone had a PC. I was sort of lucky that I would, you know, had PC gaming as my first experience. But talking to people in the community over the years, so many people, more than they ever thought, their first experience was playing Dreamcast online. It's a real, I think it's a turning point in gaming consoles. It's that bridge between old consoles and new consoles. Looking at what makes the console so appealing, and so that the retro chic to it is so so high.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there. You know, you've just unlocked some memories there of my older brother explaining to me about the Dreamcast and how playing on it online worked, and kind of like trying to compare it to our Skybox in terms of like how the internet worked with signals and stuff like that, and explain it to me in, like, I think it must have been about 99 2000, and I would have been about 10 years old trying to wrap my tiny little brain about it. So, but yeah, you kind of like really got me thinking then, you know, the Dreamcast probably was a lot of users' kind of first experience on the internet, or at least on, you know gaming online and stuff like that, which is really interesting to think about. So let's talk about the games library for the Dreamcast. So what are some of your guys' favorite Dreamcast games, and what do you think makes them stand out from other console games?
So some of my favorite games are kind of, I suppose a lot of people who play the Dreamcast have like two sides of it. So you love stuff like, in my case, I love Power Stone 2. That's my favorite. One of my favorite games, top 10, just, it's not even the most popular of the two games in that series, but I love it anyway. I love how kind of almost did a Dreamcast-y thing of taking a beloved game in the original Power Stone and just throwing everything it could at the wall and seeing if it'd stick. And, you know, it's got like moving arenas and all these ridiculous weapons. It's a very like different take on what was already a good formula. It's kind of like, instead of it being like them trying to add things, it's like they've moved it into like a different area, I suppose. And I love that game to this day, and it's still as fun as it was playing it back in the day with my friends. And then you've also got like similar games like Shenmue. Obviously, that's like the kind of de facto game that people always turn to when they're talking about the Dreamcast. It's, you know, incredibly innovative, you know, almost set the way for open world games that we see today. And there's other games like D2 as well, which is like a survival horror game that blends all these different genres. The games like Shenmue and D2, and there's a lot of other games on the Dreamcast, kind of almost question what is a game. It has you asking that question. It's like, I think obviously, you know, considering it's an arcade system, you know, you look at these arcade games, you think that's a game, and then you play a game like Shenmue and you're like, well, I have to wait here for like half an hour to like speak to this person, you know? It's like, you know, I can pick an orange up and look at it, like, why am I doing this, you know? And I think that's like, and one of the things the Dreamcast does really well is a lot of, like I was saying before, throwing mud at the wall and seeing if it'll stick. And, you know, so you've got the best of both worlds, the last breath of the arcade, you know, like I say, the experimental games, and then also you've got couch multiplayer. It had online multiplayer and light gun gaming as well. A lot of great light gun games. Not many, but House of the Dead 2 is brilliant. Confidential Mission as well. You know, and that was kind of the last breath for that, because obviously, you know, in soon HDTVs took over and, you know, those kind of games died out. But I will say on the Dreamcast, what you need to do is just play all the games like Soul Calibur, Shenmue, Jet Set Radio, but also, you know, look a bit further and find out about games like Elemental Gimmick Gear, Illbleed, Lack of Love, like games that, you know, you'll play and you're just like, no other console but the Dreamcast can do this. So yeah, there's so many good games that you can still play on the console.
Yeah, so I think my standout games sort of represent a particular aspect of Dreamcast. So Shenmue, for me, is the greatest game, I think the greatest game ever made. I was a massive Shenmue fan at the time. I had a real emotional connection to the game, which I don't think many games have ever done since. There's something about the game. People will criticize Shenmue for all of its little faults, completely overlook the point of why the game is so adored by people. You know, when Shenmue 3 was announced at E3, it was a genuinely moving moment for many of us. So that's, for me, the greatest game. I think also Le Mans 24 Hour, which is a racing game, really good racing game, holds up really well today. I think it's probably the most played game I've played on the Dreamcast, but it really has that sort of Codemasters, Race Driver, Toka series feel to it, which is my favourite genre of game anyway. Also, a shooter, one of the shoot-em-ups called Zero Gunner 2, which was a game which was at the time Dreamcast exclusive. I think it has now been ported to the Switch, but it's a really innovative sort of vertical shooter, which then sort of changed directions quite a lot, and the helicopter could move around the screen. Just a really fun, enjoyable game. And then lastly, for me, it's that sort of B-movie horror-style games. There's quite a few of them on Dreamcast. Cycle of the Dead is still possibly one of my favourite games of all time. You've got Illbleed, you've got House of the Dead 2 as well. Just that retro horror B-movie chic, which is something I love outside the Dreamcast, but it did it so well on the console.
Any love for Zombie Revenge there?
I do like Zombie Revenge. It's a good game. It's a good game. I think the problem with Zombie Revenge for me is the fact it's not Dynamite Cop. So, you know, Dynamite Cop, the game is sort of semi-sequel, I suppose, semi-spin-off, whatever you want to call it. It's Dynamite Cop, for me, is just one of the greatest experiences of gaming. I mean, you know, people will remember the appearance of a giant pink octopus for no real reason in that game for many years. A sign of what Dreamcast did, those kind of really bright, colourful utterly insane moments in gaming.
And it's interesting, you know, you mentioned the pink octopus there and the bright colourfulness. You've both mentioned, you know, that just that kind of wow factor of the color palette of the Dreamcast and the colors in there. And it's funny because even these, you know, these B-movie kind of horror games such as House of Dead 2 and you know, Zombie Revenge, even though they're these bleak, dark, violent games, they're still super colorful and they've got the green blood and everything's so like, it reminds me of like a really over the top 70s kind of like, you know, palette, if that makes sense.
Yeah. One thing I love about the Dreamcast is, you know, games are coming out for the Dreamcast at the moment, and there's a mix of indie games, there's a mix of ports as well, but also the presentation in these games is absolutely insane. Like, these are like proper releases. It's amazing. How's this kind of happened, Lewis?
I'll say cut to Mike on this one.
So we've been really lucky in Dreamcast community in the last few years. So about 7 years ago, 8 years ago, we had a publisher called Josh Rod, now known as Pixel Heart, known as both, really. They came out with some games which were officially ported games. They did Another World, Flashback, Fate of Black, things like that, but also some indie games. And they had really high-quality presentation, high-quality sort of, it was a professional publisher, not just some guy in a shed making games in his spare time. And then we've had, in the last couple of years, we've had a publisher called Wave, based in the UK, based in Norwich, I think, if I'm not being wrong enough, but yeah, based in Norwich. And so they've, I suppose, upped the game, really. They've made it even more impressive, just really high quality presentation. And I think it shows that, you know, the console has a fan base big enough to have this sort of community. We've had lots of publishers over the years. Most of them were sort of independent developers that then published their own games. But we had some other big companies, and I think it just shows how dedicated the Dreamcast community are, because I would have thought that most of these firms, most of these companies, started as Dreamcast fans. I know in the Wave's case, that's definitely the case. I know in Josh Boyd, Pixel Heart, he was a Dreamcast fan as well to begin with.
It's interesting because they're actually like negotiating the rights for these games, but also they're doing two versions of the game. So, you know, you're getting the Japanese like covers and stuff, and then also the like European one. So it's got that kind of region design, which is really nice.
Yeah. I think Wave have done quite a good job of kind of simplifying that original PAL look that the Dreamcast games had, just without those hideous, really fragile cases. You know, they've kind of done a good job of transferring the kind of blues of the European Dreamcast games onto like a normal CD case, and they look great. They look really do look good.
I do love the Dreamcast cases, but yeah, they are very flimsy. My collection, I think there's definitely more than one or two broken ones in there, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Though I mentioned that Room 101 episode. They went into Room 101.
Great stuff. So kind of speaking of the Room 101 stuff, I guess what are some of the most like common misconceptions and misunderstandings that people have about the Dreamcast, and maybe some of the things that you might agree with in that as well?
So I have two things for this. So one, the main one is that people who say it's a dead system, as we were just discussing, it regularly receives new games and good ones at that, and which also means that it's a current gen system, and I will not hear otherwise. So maybe we shouldn't be talking about it on a retro podcast, hey? But and then the second one is that I hear this loads, because me and Mike do the social media for the Dreamcast Junkyard, and we often, I mean, at least I do, I hear this, people tweet like to us about, why would you have a Dreamcast? All the best games have been ported to other systems. That is not true, not at all, not by a long shot. You know, as I was saying, if you dive deep, there's like so many great games that are just exclusive to Dreamcast, and you can't play them anywhere else. And like I was saying earlier, it's easier than ever to play burned games, to mod your console. You know, emulation for Dreamcast is exceptional, and it's like there's so many games you never knew that, you know, you'd play until you gave them a chance on the Dreamcast. So yeah, it's got a brilliant library.
I think the biggest one for me by far is the fact that if you ask 100 people You will get 100 different reasons for why the Dreamcast died, and none of them are true. I mean, it's literally that people just have this. Everyone has this conception of why the Dreamcast failed, and they will stick to that no matter what. And we've heard some incredible stories over the years, you know, about, you know, PS2 destroyed it, or it's no DVD player for some reason, it was didn't work or whatever. I could literally write or record a long series of podcasts just based on the various different reasons for Dreamcast's demise. But going back to what Linus said, the console didn't really ever die. And I think that's something which a lot of people are quite surprised by. I've seen more than one comment where someone says, oh, I didn't realize Dreamcast still had games being released, or, oh, I didn't realize Dreamcast had this game or that game. So there's lots of misconceptions just based on, I think, probably childhood memories of the time. You know, if you were only 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever at the time, and you weren't really keeping up with what had happened with the consoles, then I think people just thought Dreamcast came and went very quickly, and no one really cared about it. But in actual fact, there's a very deep and interesting community around it.
Yeah, I've got a question to ask as well, which is, do you think we'll ever see a Dreamcast Mini? And why hasn't Sega done it already?
I think it's inevitable. I think the console is inevitable. And I think that the reason they haven't done it so far is, I think, just because of licensing rights and things like that. I think, you know, a lot of the Dreamcast games, you know, it's not like a Mega Drive Mini where the game is pretty much just the game itself, which you have to license or, you know, get the permissions for. If you've got something like Dreamcast, it's a bit harder when you've got, you know, soundtracks that are pretty elaborate and you've got to get all the permissions from them. And also, I think it's a bit more costly. I mean, you know, yes, you can probably play Dreamcast on quite a cheap emulation device. We know that now. But comparatively to what Mega Drive or SNES or something like that would have done, it's a bit different. So, well, I think it's inevitable. I think it's inevitable that we'll get one. I think it'll be before we get a Saturn. I think it'll be before we get a Master System, if we ever get a Master System one. I think it's going to be the next one Sega releases. I just don't know when that's going to be.
They've just got to sort those rights out with the Offspring for Crazy Taxi.
Yeah, if they can get Dex to sign the rights over for the Offspring songs, and also get Greg and Brett to sign over the rights for Bad Religion songs, then we'll all be happy.
Yeah, I think Sega have taken notice, though.
Yeah.
You know, the merch has kind of increased for Dreamcast. I mean, recently that Hallmark are doing a Christmas decoration of the Dreamcast.
Yeah,
which is like, I don't know, it's like I was a little bit surprised by that, because I was like, do they really think the nostalgia market for Dreamcast is that big? But I guess maybe it is. And so yeah, hopefully it'll result in, you know, a Dreamcast Mini rather than another mini Mega Drive, because we've had plenty of those. So yeah.
The Genesis Free Mini, you know, the little the one they sold in America in like 96 or something.
Nomad Mini is sort of the next one.
I would love a Nomad Mini, to be fair.
It would be very cool, to be fair. Yeah, it would be better than the app games versions.
Yeah.
Brilliant. So what advice would you give to someone who's, you know, just discovering the Dreamcast or is brand new to the Dreamcast? You know, they're trying to start out and explore the games library and the history of it. What games and accessories would you kind of, you know, recommend, or how to kind of like sink your teeth into it?
I will pre-warn people that the Dreamcast hardware has some shortcomings. It has a tendency to be quite temperamental, whether it be the GD-ROM drive failing, you know, it having a random reset. But like I've said, like, we're in a better time than ever for mods and, you know, fixing consoles, and the information out there is like spot on as well. Like, when I first started getting really into Dreamcast, I'm like experiencing these technical issues and I'm like searching around and this guy says this and that person says this, you know. And so, you know, it's not like a minefield anymore. Like, you can go on a forum like Dreamcast Talk and like get a proper definitive answer for stuff like that. So that's good. And then also, if, you know, I'd say go on any of these like lists. Dreamcast Junkyard has its own list, actually, that was voted for by the community. You know, check those lists out. You know, it has like the definitive games, but you know, play Shenmue, play Jet Set Radio, play Soul Calibur, Crazy Taxi, all those great games, you'll love them. But like I was saying, just, you know, have a look at, you know, some games, you know, that don't always make those top lists, you know, the ones that kind of sit in the background and kind of, you know, a little bit more obscure, because those are great as well. So yeah, I'd recommend that.
Wicked. And I guess our final question is going to be for you, Mike. Tell us about your book that you've been working on for the last couple of years.
Yeah, so I speculated on about the fact of how I came to the Dreamcast Junkyard, as I sent Tom Charnock a list of games, and we sort of published that, and then got a cease and desist order from Sega for this very short list book, which I proudly have in my games wall. But no, so I sort of set myself a challenge after that to write reviews and actually do a full sort of book with a proper collecting guide. And I think most people thought I was insane, which, you know, fair enough, I am. But I stuck to it, and I did. So I actually wrote it. I pretty much wrote the entire guide by 2018 time. Mm. And then since then, I've basically just been reworking it, rewording it, editing it, adding things to it, to make it a sort of definitive A to Z of the console. From a collector's point of view, so you know, I'm not going to stand here and say that I'm the best writer in the world. I'm certainly not. So it is aimed towards collectors. There are reviews of the game in there as well, but it's for people who want to, you know, discover the Brazilian library, or want to discover the various Japanese versions of games. So yeah, it's the A to Z of Dreamcast games. Hopefully out by around August time. That's my aim. No particular reason. Just picked a nice sunny month, really. But yeah, it's going quite well. I've got a team of four people edit it, including Lewis here, helping me out a little bit. Obviously, it's all done in spare time. It's going to be done for not for profit. I'm not interested in doing it for profit. But there's hopefully going to be a physical version of it out by late summer.
Fantastic. Well, that sounds absolutely amazing, and really looking forward to having that. And when it does come out, we'll have to get you back on, you know, to talk about it in the news segment. So
excellent. Yeah.
Just to add to that, Andrew Dickinson's Dreamcast Year 2 book is like printed and is going to be released imminently. So that's another one that's really exciting. There's a lot of writing from people like me, Mike, and the other Junkyard guys in there as well. So I recommend people check that out when it's out as well.
Fantastic. We'll have to plug that as well. Brilliant. Well, thank you so much for coming on, guys. That's been really, really fun, and our jam-packed full of Dreamcast, and certainly one of our favourite consoles on the Retro Hour. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you for having us. It's been a blast. Yeah.